Good morale on a team implies goodwill. It implies friendship. It implies honor. It implies respect. And it implies submission. And that's true in your little hut, two of you who are single, and that's true of you who are married. I've quoted this verse before, and I would like to do it again as what I believe an objective that any people have to accept if they're going to function happily together. 1 Corinthians 1:10. I beseech you, brethren, by the name of our Lord Jesus Christ, that you all speak the same thing, and that there be no divisions among you, but that you be perfectly joined together in the same mind and in the same judgment. People who walk together must be agreed, or there are going to be clashes. One is going to turn left and the other is going to turn right, and you're going to find yourself getting out of step with each other. You're going to find yourself running into each other if there isn't a constant, continuous effort at arriving at a mutual way of doing things. Philippians chapter 2, beginning with the first verse, says the same thing. If there be any consolation in Christ, if any comfort of love, if any fellowship of the Spirit, if any bowels and mercies, then fulfill ye my joy that ye be like-minded, having the same love, being of one accord and of one mind. All the poor, unfortunate children who are caught between a man and a woman who can't agree on how to raise them. And I've seen this tragedy over and over again, and I'm sure this is part of our adolescent tragedy today. A poor young fella and a poor young girl caught between a mother and a father who can't agree on how to approach that person. And all the miserable partners who can't agree on how they're going to operate. To be like-minded, to be of one accord, to have the same spirit, to submit to a mutual way of life, is the formula for happiness together. And this, I say, applies to two single people living together, and it applies to a husband and a wife. Now, many single people would say, oh, it's so much easier for a man and a wife to live together. For instance, they have this matter of expressing affection one to another, and we haven't got this privilege. But you have no idea how miserable it is to live with someone of the opposite sex who's mad at you. And the matter of the sexual relationship is not a physical thing at all. Well, not, that's too strong. But one of my teachers was saying that the sexual relationship is 25% physical and 75% emotional. And this can be a complication, not an advantage. If these people are haggling and arguing and fighting with each other all day long, they cannot submit themselves one to another successfully in a relationship that's as close as the sexual relationship. So this can become a burden, a terrible burden. And the expression of affection implies someone who will receive it. I think this seems obvious to me. Let nothing be done through strife or vainglory, but in lowliness of mind let each esteem the other better than themselves. This is the formula for a congenial partnership. Now, I would like to turn to a passage that I have found in Christian circles to be a very troublesome one. Ephesians 5, beginning with the 22nd verse. Wives, submit yourselves to your own husbands, I like that. Don't you? But you know, that isn't what it says. Many a man reads that far and stops. Now, I'd like to say this, that this matter of one person submitting to another is necessary at any time when there are two people or more involved. I would say that in a partnership between two people living in the same hut, and even though you aren't married, one of you had better take the lead. It's inevitable in relationships between two people that there are going to be some issues that are where you're not going to come to a meeting of minds. And when you can't come to a meeting of minds, somebody's got to make the decision. Who? And it's all Paul is simply suggesting here that it should be the husband. Now, that's not a very palatable job to have the last word. The president of a company, the director of a mission, who has to make a decision because people cannot make it themselves and people cannot come to a meeting of minds, believe me, is in a hot spot. He's in a tough position. And when any two people get to the point where they realize that this is an unsolvable problem, that's a tough spot, a real tough spot. And the person who's charged with making that decision, he's got a difficult task. And I think it's such a tragic thing when a man takes this to mean that for a wife, my wife is to submit to me. That means she is to put her mind into neutral and quit thinking. And from now on, all she needs to do is what I tell her to do, whether it's right or wrong, wise or unwise. Doesn't make a bit of difference. Quit thinking. Did you, any of you men who are married, ever realize that your wives have quit thinking? And I don't think that's the implication at all here. It says, wives, submit yourself to your own husbands as unto the Lord. And if we submit ourselves unto the Lord, we don't submit ourselves to some vague program because we know what we're to submit to. It goes on to say the husband is the head of the wife, even as Christ is the head of the church, and he is the Savior of the body. Now, what kind of a man are you to submit to? A man who looks upon his wife as Christ looked upon the church, and Christ said, I am come not to be ministered unto. You get that? Jesus said, I did not come to be ministered unto, but to minister. And to give my life a ransom for many. Now, as I understand it, the Bible is rather vague about what part of the world I should go to. And it's rather vague about the kind of job I should do, but the Bible is very clear on how I should treat my wife. And I'm to give myself to my wife, not have her just wait on me. It seems to me that it's my responsibility to help my wife to become the best possible person that she can be. What a fool I would be if I would have expected my wife to put her mind into neutral. She's smarter than I am in a lot of ways. She's got some insights into life that I haven't got. And my wife and I together are much better individually than we could possibly be separately. Now, this can be true between you and your partner, too, if you're a single girl. The two of you together can be so much superior individually than you could possibly be alone if you approach your partnership in the spirit. I think of a friend of mine, two friends of mine. One is a president of a bank and one is a vice president. And I want to cast this word submission. This is a tough word in the American culture, submission. Because we want to be individualistic. Hey, what about me? And submission seems to imply, as I say, putting your mind into neutral and quit thinking and just take somebody else's orders, whether they're wise or unwise, whether they're smart or dumb. You haven't got anything more to say. That's submission. I don't think that's what it means. This president of the bank, he's top man in the bank. But the bank doesn't exist to serve him. He exists to serve the bank. He is looking out for the best interests of that bank. And that bank doesn't exist for him to express any crazy kind of a whim that he would like to express. Now, his friend is the vice president of that bank. There's never any doubt about who the boss is. But these two fellows are friends. They're buddies. They respect each other. They honor each other. They have a high regard for each other. And together, they establish the policies that dictate how that bank operates. That vice president is in submission to the president. The president is top man. But the two of them together are submitting to the same standards that both of them helped to develop. And these men, both of them together, are bound by those same standards. So when the president takes off, nothing happens. The vice president hasn't got some favorite little deposit slips that he quick brings out when the president's gone. And the people in the bank don't breathe easier and say, well, now we can go back to normal. The president's gone. The president and the vice president together built the policies, and they are both bound by those policies. And it's a very rare experience, these two men who have worked together for 30 years, that there's ever something comes up that these two men can't work out together. Just about everything's been covered that would come up in that bank. And everybody knows, as everybody that walks into that bank and wants to deposit some money, they know how to do it. And they know what's going to happen to that money, and they know how to get it out. But when those times do come, and there's an issue in the bank, and it's up to the president to make that decision, that's a rare instance. And a very serious moment in the life of that bank. And that president weighs that situation very, very seriously, because what he is charged with doing is making a decision that is in the best interest of that bank. I believe that this is the responsibility of a husband. And in a marriage or in a relationship between two single women, the longer you are together, the more solid should be the policies and the procedures, and the more routine everything should become, and the crises where there are unsolvable decisions should become fewer and fewer and fewer and fewer and fewer. And if a man and a woman, or if two partners are still haggling after a week about how high to raise the window at night, or how to arrange the furniture, or how to approach the children, or anything else, I'd say that something wrong. A relationship cannot stand too many differences, or you call it sick. And a man and a woman, or two partners who are still haggling over anything, after they've discussed it, and after they've looked at all sides of it, and if they were not able to come to a conclusion, and this festers and festers and festers and festers, I say that that relationship is sick. And this is why in any relationship you've got to have a head, because inevitably there are those moments when it's very difficult to make a decision. Somebody's got to make it. Who? It should be clear who. On a football team, everybody knows who the captain is. He makes the decision. And you don't have a huddle because you're having a discussion about the decision. That huddle is simply to get your signals. Now, the fellow in the middle of that huddle who's calling the signals, he is bound by the number of plays that these men are capable of carrying out. And he isn't free to make any kind of a bizarre call in that huddle that he feels like making. So that the fellow who calls the signals pretty much calls the kind of signal that most of the fellows in that group would have called anyway, if it's a good football team. And in your organization, the signal that any of your leaders call ought to be quite a predictable decision. If your organization has any kind of heritage at all and any kind of morale at all. And when you hear about people who are haggling and scrapping and fighting about an issue and they can't come to a conclusion on it, we say that's low morale. An athletic team that is every man for himself and they can't get together on how to play, we say the morale is low on that team. There shouldn't ever be a decision, there shouldn't ever be an issue that isn't decided. Whether it's in your organization, whether it's in your marriage, whether it's two roommates working together, you should have the machinery that tells you how you carry an issue to its conclusion, and they should be concluded. I believe this is the challenge of Christian living. Like-mindedness, having the same mind and the same judgment. I tell you, to play on a team where everybody agrees, what a joy that is. To walk together in step. You ever watch people walking along wanting to get into step? It's not pleasant even to walk alongside of somebody down the street when you're out of step. What a joy to be in step. What a joy to work together with someone when his actions are predictable and your actions are predictable, and the two of you know that you're bound by the same standards that the two of you have helped to build and make. Yes, the husband should be the head of the wife, but only to see to it that the outfit keeps going along a pathway that the two of you helped to build. A direction that the two of you have set. And you're both heading in the right direction with your heart and soul and mind, and you're doing it at the same pace. You voluntarily got into that harness. And you've built a way of life that is mutually satisfactory to both of you. Now, may I ask you, is your partnership a contest? Is your marriage a contest? A protest? Or is it a team? Where you're like-minded, you have the same judgment, same spirit, you're heading for the same goal. You don't know you, so your kid's going to, whoever they go to, they get the same answer. Because both of you subscribe to the same viewpoint. Does this describe your relationship, your little hut, your little home? Now, I would like to repeat here that submission implies a voluntary commitment to a way of life that you help to create and that you're sold on, and that the captain doesn't have much more freedom than the rest of the fellows. He's bound by the same standards. And I repeat that the longer two people are together, if they walk together in the proper spirit, the smoother it ought to go. Well, this is one of the things you see in high school athletics. You get a bunch of freshmen together, and by the time they're seniors, they got a good team. A marriage should be that way. It should be smoother and smoother and smoother and smoother as you go. A partnership of any kind between two people should be the same way. Now, in business, and I think this is a very common understanding, that in business, one of the most difficult kinds of business arrangements to maintain is a partnership. Trying to reconcile the wills of two people is one of the most difficult, challenging relationships. So, but one of the most satisfying relationships. Is the one where the head is dedicated to the best interests of the people that he is responsible for. What can I do to make this a better partnership? What can I do to make that person that is depending on me the best possible person that one can be? This is the responsibility of the head. This is not to say that the head is to be catered to and waited on. He can have his own way, and it's tough that you're not the head. Too bad. So may I repeat then, headship is basic and fundamental in a partnership. Whether it's two women living in the same hut, or a man and a wife, or a doubles team in tennis, or two men trying to run a business, someone, there has to be a very clear, clean-cut, mutually binding and mutually acceptable understanding as to who does what, and it's the head's responsibility to carry it out. And given this kind of a foundation, then we can talk about introducing more people into this relationship, which is simply all that a family amounts to. Well, my time is up, and we will continue with this at 4.
I'd like to say just a few things before I open this up for your questions. Family living is I have found to be as good a test of my own character as any relationship that I have ever taken part in. Not because it's marriage, I don't think, but because it's putting myself in a situation that I can't get out of. I think most partnerships where you're in a situation that you can't get out of is a real test of your character, because it involves putting together two people who each have to lay down their lives and come out with something that is mutually binding on both of them. And then there are always these unexpected things that come up. For instance, I can remember one time I was in college. We had three children at the time. And we were going to have the president of the college over for supper that night. And that was a big event. It was to me, anyway. That's the first time in our lives we ever had the president of a college over. And my wife scoured that house like it had never been scoured before. And I've sometimes said to myself, you know, it would be nice if I got treated like a stranger. Did you ever stop to think how carefully you treat a stranger? He gets real careful treatment, red carpet treatment. Well, we taught the kids, well, we practically wrote the kids a script for that night. Because everything was going to turn out just right. And we got the president up to the table without anything happening. But one thing I learned during that experience is never write a script for your kids. We got absorbed at the table in listening to him talking, and little Sue, about three, said to him, "Would you pass the salt?" Well, nobody paid any attention to the little kid. We were listening to the president of the college talk. And she said once more, "Would you pass the salt?" And she didn't get anywhere. So the third time she tugs at his sleeve and says, "Pass the salt or I'll knock your block off." Now, it's real nice to plan ahead and decide what you're going to do and who does what in family living, but you're forever coming across these unexpected turns in the road, aren't you? And you don't quite know what to do. And at that point, the thing that interests me is that I tell that story everywhere, and everybody thinks it's funny. Everybody. Now, wouldn't it be nice if we could see the humor in things as we're living through them? As if only we could do that. And I think if we walked in the proper spirit, and if we could appreciate the nature of the task that is ours and the various tasks that befall us, that we would be able to really chuckle our way through life. But I didn't think that was funny at all. And those are the kind of moments when you decide whether to knock their blocks off, or you don't know whether you should laugh or smile or cry or what. But we've had those kinds of experience again and again and again in our lives. And I think any partnership has them. So we've had to decide in our partnership how we're going to do this. Now, I want to say one more thing. And before I give you an opportunity to ask questions, which has to do with communication, and I speak to this remark that Jesus made out of the 5th chapter of Matthew. He speaks this way: "If you bring your gift to the altar, and there remember that your brother hath aught against you, then leave there your gift before the altar, and go your way, and first be reconciled to your brother, and then come and offer your gift." Now, I've read lots of places of the importance of communication, the importance of sitting down and talking your problems over. And yet I've had so many people coming to my office who said that they have been disappointed in this attempt at sitting down and talking their problems over, because after they got through talking things over, they only had a clearer picture of how they differed. That's all. Do you get what I mean? Unless you sit down to talk with the particular purpose in mind, and that is to be reconciled, I doubt whether conversation is of much value. Now, many people will sit down and start a conversation simply because they figure that if the other fellow understands how I feel, they'll let me have my own way. And this is the purpose for the conversation. Now, if a conversation is only for the purpose of exchanging views, then after you're through, that's exactly what you've done. You've exchanged views. No more, no less. And I'm not so sure that exchanging views is very helpful in a partnership. It might be in a seminar, but in a partnership or in working with anyone that you have to relate yourself to, communication ought to be based upon the idea that we must be reconciled. I think a partnership, this is one of the fundamental bases upon which a partnership will be built. The desire to communicate with the purpose in mind of being reconciled and of coming up with a way of life that is binding on both of you. Now, with that, I'll stop and see what kind of questions there are based on what I had to say this morning and now. Are there any questions?
I have one specific question regarding a specific kind of partnership, namely the partnership of single people. I realize that you mentioned this morning that the principles are the same, problems are the same, and I would grant that, but this one particular point I think is different. In the family setup, the scripture sets up who is the boss, who makes the rules. In your situation of your bank president and vice president and all comparable things, it's set by the fact of the offices. But in a partnership, when two single girls or two single fellows start out together, there's no rules set up for who's going to decide who makes the rules. And I wonder if you had any particular suggestions along this line. Let me qualify it, too. I wondered if you would think in this situation it would be needful that one would be the boss in all situations, the final, not boss in, I understand what you mean by boss, the one that makes the final decisions. Or if under certain kinds of things one would be and another kinds of things another would be.
Well, in an organization like this, the leaders are chosen. They come up, don't they? It's true that in a marriage, the husband is supposed to be the head. And theoretically, the wife is supposed to follow him. Now, this becomes a very difficult thing, even in a marriage. So that just because the Bible says that the husband should be the head, this does not mean that everybody agrees that that's true. And it doesn't mean that a woman will accept that, nor does it mean that a husband will accept it. So that in our country, I think we find that this is not an easy concept, even in a marriage, of someone accepting the fact of having a last word. Freedom, equality, individuality is the order of the day. In a partnership and involving two women, and I get involved in this quite a bit in my own office, where two women have gotten together. They were good friends. They thought it would be wonderful to share an apartment. And then they couldn't figure out what to do with all the furniture. That was one problem. I think of one girl. Why, they had a terrible time because she took it for granted that you finish one loaf of bread before you open another one. And her roommate was opening two loaves of bread at once. One of them decided that it's enough to wash dishes once a day, and the other one felt that you ought to keep the sink clean all the time. So here they were. Now, who is going to be boss? How are we going to work this out? We came together and assuming equality, assuming equal rights. Now, how are we going to work this out? And there is no way to work it out. You can't assume equal rights. Two people must assess the strengths and the qualities and the weaknesses of one another. And you're simply going to have to arbitrarily determine who calls the shots. Now you say, how? I say this is something that the two of you simply must work out. Now, if your partner cannot accept the fact that she should submit, then I can think of one solution. You submit. Now, why not? Is your partner that bad? You see, there's no way, no simple way. This same thing applies to a husband and a wife. It's not true that a woman just simply submits. This is a continuous, constant problem, and there is no simple solution to it. And what we're talking about here is really the fundamental spirit of a person who says, I will not submit. Now, we should not assume, I don't think we need to assume, that submission is bad. And I don't think that we need to assume the ill will of the person who takes the lead. It seems to me that this is no tragedy because someone has to take the lead. I see no other way of doing it. Now, in our house, I think I'm the head of the house, but dear me, that doesn't mean that my wife's mind is neutral. For instance, my wife is in complete charge of all the purchasing. Very happy to turn it over to her. I haven't got time to be bothered with it. And she has to buy all the clothes, she has to buy all of the food, she determines a lot of the things about the house, and this is her complete responsibility as far as I'm concerned and as far as she's concerned. Now, except within the limits of some broad understandings that we have about neatness, this is her complete concern. Now, I don't see why two girls can't, even though one takes the lead in bringing things up, I don't see why they can't divide things up. Why can't one of them be responsible for the, say, buying of the food? I see no reason why two people can't sit down and devise a mutually satisfactory way of life. Now, in a combination like that, where there are two women, one generally is tends to take the lead more than the other, and I would think that it would almost naturally develop, provided people come at it with the idea that one of us must or ought to take the lead. Now, if you come at it with the idea that there shouldn't be a leader, there won't be. But that's not only true between two single girls, that's true between a husband and a wife, too. Anybody else? Now, if you wanted a magic formula that just goes click, click,
I haven't got one to offer you.
Wants to speak up. I just want to clear the record that I wasn't asking, what do I do when I want to lead and my partner wants to lead? I was thinking from the standpoint of supposing both accept the idea and neither one necessarily wants to take the lead. Just, I wonder if you had any suggestions about it. But I think you've answered the question from the standpoint of there might not be necessarily one in all things, but in certain departments, even as your wife is head, in a sense, in the kitchen.
Well, even so, somebody needs to take the lead to set it up. Now, you say neither one really wants to take the lead is the thing that troubles me, because, and this is a very common thing, the idea that taking the lead is an undesirable thing. It's not good. And I think this is a common idea, that that there's something wrong with submission, or there's something wrong with leadership. So I think the important thing, the important starting point is that this is a good thing, not a bad thing. This is not a tragedy. This is not the end of your freedom. This is just simply a way of doing things that will smooth out your relationship. And if the other person doesn't want to take the lead, then I would suggest you take it. Then you have a very simple problem if the other person doesn't want it. That makes it real easy, doesn't it? Whoever your partner is. Well, you say, if there is a partnership where neither person wants to take the lead, well, all right, then the assumption is your partner doesn't want it. That's real easy. Then you take it. Here's a...
But perhaps taking the lead means taking all the responsibility and doing all the work. In which case, that person may get rather tired of it after a while.
Well, I think then I must repeat that any relationship involves developing a way of life that is mutually acceptable and mutually binding. Now, undergirding this whole thing, as I pointed out this morning, I imply goodwill, I imply honor, I imply respect, I imply love, I imply friendship, I imply the desire to develop and help one another. Does that answer your question? See, I'm not talking about dumping. Again, I'm not implying dumping a distasteful task in your lap. That's not what leadership is. It's simply a matter of one of you taking the lead in the development of something that is going to involve both of you. Here's a hand here.
In the situation that many of us find ourselves in, we are bringing our children up in front of people all the time, or a good deal of the time. Now, I wonder how much should we say, well, I am fully convinced in my own mind that this is the way I want to bring up my child, and yet knowing fully well that somebody else is very disapproving of that particular thing that you might be thinking of at the time. how much should we concede to other opinions and how much should we carry forth on what we believe in our own minds?
Well, I don't think any of us live unto ourselves. And surely we need to consider and honor other people's ways of doing things. Now, when you come into my home as my guest, I would expect you to honor our way of doing things. You're my guest. If I come into your home as your guest, I think you would have a right to expect, I would have a right to expect you to honor our way of doing things. So when you're traveling around as a family, then it seems to me that you have to accept this. That when you enter someone else's home, that you've got to honor their way of doing things.
I wasn't referring particularly to being in somebody else's home, but I'm referring to, for instance, in a situation like this here, where we are with so many other people.
Well, of course, I would think that here you have a nice, neat tangle. And you're dumping everybody together. And unless you have a Wycliffe-type rule for this place that everybody conforms to, you're here long enough to work out anything that's mutually agreeable. So I would imagine the best that you could hope for would be chaos. Am I right? And I wouldn't be too disturbed about it. For instance, my office is this thing working? My office is over here under the tree, one of those cement benches. And it's right near that fence where they corral all the kids. And I see these women bring their children over there and walk off. Some bring them in and leave them there and leave. Other mothers bring them in and they look like they're taking their children to drop them over a cliff or something. The mothers look so scared and worried or guilty or something. I don't know, anything but happy. And the poor kids cling to their mothers, and the mothers cling to their kids. And the mother says, "Don't you want to stay here?" And the little child says, "No." And the mother says, "Oh, but I think you should." And the little child says, "But I don't want to." And then the mother, it's the mother clinging to the child, not the child clinging to the mother. And then the mother says, "Oh, please look happy about it." No, not in so many words. So you have every kind of approach to that pen over there that you can imagine. Now, I don't think that... Still, is it working? I don't think that you can hope for much better than that. Now, I would suggest this in a place like this, though. That you might give some thought to a set of rules that applies to all parents that bring their kids here. And there's a real creative project for you. There's somebody over there.
I think we have another problem which faces a lot of parents living in a group situation at our headquarters, which is a longer period of time, sometimes for months. And as Gwen brought up, this problem of having different standards for different children, I'll give you a specific illustration to ask you how to deal with it. Our boy, we've been teaching him scripture, be ye kind to one another, tender-hearted, forgiving one another. And I've been teaching him to apply that on the in the patio in Mexico City, too, that he's to be kind to the other children, he's not to fight back, and so on. Well, there sometimes he rebels against it. For instance, recently, he didn't want to share his toys. He shared to a certain extent, and another child continued to grab and take. And I said, remember that Jesus says we're to be kind and share. And he turned to me and said, yes, but Mother, the Bible says thou shalt not covet, and this child's coveting. But then there's a specific situation in which I have told him he's not to fight back. And I'm told that I'm making a sissy of him. And I was told just recently to let somebody clean up on him several times that might be good for him. I don't feel that it's scriptural. What should you do with those two standards? The other mother feels that it's all right for her child to clean up on the other children.
You're not talking about something that's peculiar to Mexico. You're talking about something that's peculiar to any two neighbors anywhere. Now, once more, I think that if you're in a group situation and you're sharing a group house, or you're sharing a neighborhood situation, that you've got to come out with something that's standard, that is mutually agreeable and mutually acceptable when your children mix. Now, I'll grant you that this isn't easy. And we're coming right back to the thing that I've been spending 4 days talking about. I'm trying to point out that before you can build a way of life in a when more than one person's life crosses another, that you've got to have the kind of a person who is not selfish, and people who are purposed to find a mutual way of life. Now, to say that kindness means giving all your toys away, I'm not so sure I agree that that's an evidence of kindness. Or to say that love means don't defend yourself, I'm not so sure I agree that that's true either. Because here you are, so one little guy standing up against another little guy, and I think what you're doing is presenting some concepts that are beyond these kids, really. Either one of them. And I would say that if you put your kids and someone else's kids together, you'd be wise for somebody to supervise those children. And that supervision ought to be based upon some common understanding between the parents involved. Now, at our house, we've always got a bunch of kids around our house. Always. Always did have. We had to decide a long time ago whether we wanted to grow kids or grass. And we voted on kids. Because we wanted our children to learn how to live with kids, and we wanted to have something to say about it, and we found that most neighbors were delighted to get rid of them. And so there they were in our yard. But when they came into our yard, they did it our way, too. And so I think you ought to be quite comfortable in being clear in your own mind how you expect children to conduct themselves at your house, and expect any of them that come along to fit in. But you're going to have to help them fit in. Now, this concept of sharing, that's a pretty complicated concept for a little kid. I can remember trying to teach that to our kids, taking turns, for instance. Now, one little kid walks up to another one and grabs his truck away and says, let's take turns.
Well, he's getting the idea. But he hasn't quite got it yet. And so we said to take it away from him and give it back to the other boy and say, now, taking turns means when he's finished with it, you can have it. And then, of course, you've got to watch him and make sure that he isn't just overdoing keeping it. So this business of teaching kids to take turns requires the presence of an adult, not just sitting down at breakfast and saying, now, you go out and share it today, Johnny. Now, when you can't work out a common way for you and your neighbor, when you have children and your neighbor has children, and you say, I want my son to be defenseless, and the lady next door says, I want my son to fight. Now there you are, two Christian ladies. Both of you, I assume, with Wycliffe. Now, here are two women who have to work together. And I say that here comes a real fundamental spiritual issue. Here are two people who must find a way that is mutually acceptable to both of them. Now, what does that mean? It means that you can't do what you want to do, and it means she can't do what she wants to do, and it means that you're going to have to come out with a way of life that both of you can agree on. And this will take you right back to what kind of people you are as individuals and what kind of spirit you have. Now, I don't know if that answers your question at all. She would like to speak.
For the benefit of the group who know who I'm talking about, I would like to say that these two boys play together very happily most of the time, and today especially, I notice when they're let alone that there's no problem, and if they're supervised, there's no problem, particularly, except that a few instances. And this mother who mentioned that he should clean up on him, I think the boy doesn't have the idea quite yet that he should clean up on him. But when he does get the idea, he will try to clean up on him, if he hears anybody say it.
Right. Now, supervision is certainly one fundamental requirement in helping children get along. But it's a tragic thing when the supervision is one thing one day, when one mother is there, and the reverse the next day when another one is there. That's the most confusing thing that you can do to a child. This contributes to the insecurity of a child more than anything else that I can think of conflicting approaches to children.
You never gave us the finish of your story of the college president in your home. I'm wondering, when your child does something to embarrass another under such circumstances as that, have you got any, perhaps you don't want to tell us the finish of that story, but what would you suggest might be done?
Well, I'll tell you, I didn't know what to do. So that's what I did. I didn't do anything. I don't think that. What would you have done? I didn't see that hitting her would help her. I'll tell you, I would put it this way. You have 20 years to raise a child. And I think that it is a mistake to make a crisis out of a detail. And I considered that to be a detail. Just a little detail. I see you all got a good belly laugh out of it, didn't you? It wasn't that bad. Now, after all, in the long run, in a long range,
Well, of course, we're going to teach her to respect adults, but she thought she was being pretty funny, and so did you. And in that case, so did the president. But I think that we have to be careful when children do something like that, that we remember that we're raising a child here, and we should do what we're going to do in terms of the child and not so much in terms of what does this adult think we ought to do. Or I must redeem myself as a parent in the eyes of this adult. So I think that most of the things that happen, if you put them in perspective, are really one incident is not a very important thing. To be cracking down on kids and making a great big issue out of a little detail, I think is very unnecessary. There you are.
There are times when an individual is under heavy responsibilities, and I, for one, become pretty rotten in character with my wife and my children, especially. And my wife has to suffer with my impatience and sharp remarks and adverse criticisms at such times. Generally, I have very great difficulty in trying to overcome this at the time I'm going through the experience. This is when I have responsibilities and time is short, or when I am tired. Now, I don't think this is ideal. Fortunately, I have a wife who has adjusted to such circumstances and keeps quiet and is lovely in at such times, so that there is a happy meeting of minds, as it were, with me pushing through like a wild bull or something. But I was wondering what you would have to offer in such circumstances.
Mm-hmm. I remember one time on, is it the Ladies Home Journal that has these cartoons, interesting cartoons every month? One month they had one. There was a fella getting bawled out by his boss. Well, you just don't talk back to your boss, do you? And so the next picture, he was bawling out his wife. And in the next picture, the wife was swatting the baby. And the next picture, he was bawling out his wife. And in the next picture, the wife was swatting the baby. And in the next picture, the baby was hitting the cat. And so you get this kind of a chain reaction way down the line. Why? It wasn't the cat's problem. It wasn't the baby. It wasn't the wife. But here was a fellow. Well, forget that illustration. But in coming to your point here, you probably are confronted with irritating situations day in and day out in your responsibilities, and you are responding irritably. You can't tell him off, but you're irritable just the same, and so you hold it in. And you multiply these little irritating situations one by one by one by one by one. Pretty soon you got quite a stack of them. And you just cannot afford to tell these people off. But you come home and you're pretty tense, and the next thing that happens, they're going to get the whole works. And sometimes it's a poor wife
that gets it, or sometimes it's a child that gets it. So that you can be filled with all kinds of tensions when you come home, and a little child might come in and slam the door and you wail the daylights out of that child, not because, all out of proportion to what happened. Now what you've got to do is back up and deal with these irritants as they come along. Now, in the first place, this is a matter of the spirit. And this is a matter of recognizing before God, I'm an angry man. And this is a matter of recognizing that you need a change of heart. And it means that you've got to identify those people that gripe you and admit it before God and walk moment by moment repentantly before God. Follow me?